On this episode of The Flatus Show, more New York stories. Lazier D'Amour and Sweeney Todd are the two subjects. This and more. The Flatus Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flatus Show. Tab for my diet. Welcome to the Flatus Show. I'm Kenty. Jose's in the other room taking a nap, as always. He is metabolically speaking, like something like 82. So, I mean, little Jose's 14. So he sleeps more and more. But he's a wonderful little doggy. He gives me notes. He listens to the show and gives me notes of what I should do and shouldn't do. So anyway, welcome to The Flatus Show. I'm Kenty. You can reach me at kenty@theflatusshow.com. Also reach me at 206-339-JOSE. Also visit my website at www.theflatusshow.com. And I have all sorts of things there for you to look at. I have from pictures up from last week, I talked about Rodelinda. I had the little Rodelinda section, and I said I had pictures up with that, with those trips, with that pictures from that trip, and it's the New York trip, and they are up. Also in this trip is the Lazier D'Amour opera I saw, and Sweeney Todd, the new Sweeney Todd with Peg LaPone and Michael Cerveris, I think his name is. So this episode is going to be those sections of that New York trip. So that's what you'll hear. And also the Brenda Starr update. So let's see here. Anything new going on? Well, there's a lot of changes going on personally. So more about that later. And probably some changes with the Flatus Show coming up in a few weeks. Trying to learn more songs. I have, you know, about 80 pieces of sheet music I've bought over the past, you know, two or three months or whatever. I found, been trying to scoop up as much of this old sheet music as I could find, because it was for ukulele. But at the same time, I don't know the music, so I have to learn it, and that means, even though it's fairly simple, it's still, you know, still you have to learn the melodies and stuff, and that takes time. So this week, the ukulele playing is going to be a couple children's songs. You'll hear them. So how are all my Flatus listeners doing? I've been seeing that I've been getting more and more downloads in my show. Feedburner tells me that I've had I've had more subscribers and stuff. It goes up and down, so that's good. But I know I have when they stay up, when my shows stay up for the 10 weeks or whatever, I have like a couple hundred downloads. So who is listening? I also found I have some downloads from China. China is listening, and Turkey is listening. They're the two, like, you know, places. Also Washington DC. I have a lot of places from Washington DC. So who are you? Let's see, who else is there? New Jersey. There's New Jersey. And there's a couple places in California, but I know I have listeners out in California. I'm trying to think. Utah. I think also Utah I had. So who in Utah is listening? So tell me, you know, sign my Frapper map. And that can be found at, as I wait here, I'll talk to you while I'm scanning down here in my, let's see here, bookmarks. Where am I? Frapper Flatus, okay? We'll take a look. Maybe I have new people signed up on the Flatus Show. And let's see here. How many people does it show? It still shows 16. So there's been no change. But I'm at my Frapper map is at frapper.com/The Flatus Show. And that's, all those letters are sequential. There's no spaces. The THEFLATUS, it's SHOW. Flatus Show. So I've been doing some cleaning, getting rid of things, packing things, trying to get things organized. Just because I have a lot of crap that I wanted to get together. So that's what I've been thinking of. I'm in a state of flux. Let's see here. Anything else going on? What did I want to talk about? Anything in particular? I wanted to say some things. I never talk about my work, because I keep my work separate from my podcasting life. But I know people are curious. I work in a cubicle Monday through Friday. So, you know, that will give you an idea of what I do. I just work in a cubicle. I really do. Work in a cubicle. And there's another person in the cubicle, so it's two of us. So, that's it. I wish I had a private cubicle, but I don't think I'll have a private cubicle. Because the company doesn't have that kind of, I don't know what you would call it, culture, I guess. Two people in a cubicle. And so podcasting is something I do every week. I usually get together on Saturdays and Sundays learning the music and whatever. Though, some of the music, like I said, it's kind of hard. So this week, I was trying to learn some songs. I just couldn't get it down. I gave up. So I tried to find something that was easy to play. So I've come to a place in my playing and learning of these songs where I've sort of, I don't know how, you know, it's going to take a longer time. I need to go over a hump, I guess, and a learning curve. And as for the Flatus Show, what I wanted to do is, I was thinking about this, is podcasting. You know how when podcasting first started, they started, be a podcaster and encouraged everything. But podcasting, I think, has changed, even in the short time it's been out. It's become much more commercial. And, you know, these different podcasters. So audio blogs like mine are really are on the decline. However, I could be wrong. You know, the thing is with podcasts like mine, I have a smaller number of listeners. And basically, I guess it's people who just want to be entertained by my blog. Or I'm not really sure, you know, why. I mean, I do talk about some things, but I don't give any kind of information. It's all sort of opinion. It's editorial. It's all letters to the editor, so to speak. And so that's that, you know. So I'm glad you listen. And that's that. I thought to myself, if I was going to make money at a podcast, that'd be great. But at the same time, I don't understand. It's not that I don't understand, but I don't know if I'd want to have it be a job. You know what I mean? Because then I'd be forced to perform. And I think I do, you know, perform. But I mean, you know, week after week, it can get kind of tiring. Now, if I were to do this for a living, I would probably have more time to prepare and do things. And I'd have to talk about certain things, you know, because it'd be like a sales thing and advertising, I suppose. And that would make it, that would give it some sort of structure. I guess, you know, if I was selling something like Tab, for instance. Now, I do not make any money from the Tab company. I just like the drink. I think it's funky. And you know, I love it. You know, it's from that movie, the John Waters movie, Polyester, Cuddles. Tab for our diet. That's why I talk about Tab. I don't make any money from Tab. And I don't make any money from the ukulele stuff. Now, I do have an associate's thing from Amazon, so if you click on that, on the Amazon links on my link, you know, on the show notes or whatever, then that goes to Amazon. If you were to buy operas or whatever I have there, then I get some sort of commission. But I've had zero since I signed up and did that, because I'm not aggressive in trying to get people to buy from Amazon, from come to my page to shop on Amazon.com. I think for the most part, my listeners are also podcasters, and possibly podcasters who want to, you know, maybe make a living at this sort of thing. Who knows? Let's see here. Three podcasts. Oh, yeah. Audio Attitude. Brian from Detroit and his Audio Attitude podcast is very good. He gets together a bunch of songs and he connects it with he has like a theme throughout the whole thing. So all the songs really have something to do with what he's talking about, which I think is very good. And there's some other ones that I think are very good too. I think I talked about Rebecca from Tranny Rec Radio. She's very good. She intersperses her podcast with songs. Sometimes she just has just interviews or just talks, but usually there's some music in between, and she picks them out. So that I like the music she's picked, and she's has a very interesting show. I mean, where else are you going to find, you know, information from the viewpoint of a trans woman? You know, it's not available in mainstream America. You know, I talk about, you know, my thing is to tell my story about, you know, whatever, being gay. I mean, the more I podcast, the more I think, what is gay, what is straight? Because, I mean, the people I've met and their ideas and stuff. Now, at the very least, it's just I'm attracted to men. That's it, you know? And something I found on the internet is really interesting. There's a group of people who call themselves goys, G-0-Y. Goys are men who have attractions to other men. They may be married to women or not, but they are attracted to other men and have sex, but it's not anal sex. They're really against that. And they think gay is anal sex, is that there's feminine and butch and stuff, and it sort of degrades man. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but I understand what they're saying, is that there is this sort of dynamic in the gay community, and I think in the straight world too, they think gay is automatically anal sex, like you bend over. It's like, you know, you hear the jokes about prisoners dropping soap and stuff. It's always in the ass, treating one like a woman or whatever. So I think that's misogyny, and I think it's, you know, sort of this idea of weaker and stronger and dominant and passive, top bottom. I don't like that idea at all. And for me, I mean, my gay emotions are what these, I guess, goys describe. But basically, it is, you know, I'm attracted to men. You know, I want to form relationships with men, and, you know, not with men, with a man. I mean, I have a relationship with John. But, you know, that's where it is, you know. And I don't know. And I think it's a misconception, too, is like gays can't have sex with women. That's so wrong. I mean, there's nothing stopping me from, besides the fact that I don't want to have sex with a woman. If I had to have sex with a woman, there's nothing that stopped me from getting my dick hard and having sex with a woman. I mean, plenty of gays have done this. It's a misconception. It's just that gay men who are gay or goy or whatever, they don't want to, or I don't know about goy, but men who are gay, you know, just want to form a relationship with men, basically. Now, there are people who are into all that top and bottom and dominant and passive crap and all that, and fine for them. But the basic, I'm down to basics here. It's just men who want to live and, you know, sleep with other men. Meaning sleep is get close to. And kiss and whatever. But I'm sure you know that. But I'm just trying to make a point. It's not all about the ass. So, enough of this, and on with the show.
Lash! That's Brenda Starr, you hear, finishing up her scoop just for you.
Tuna has a new restaurant. Where we left off. Tuna has a new restaurant. He's dating the woman who had tried to poison Rock back at the very early part of the story, the Rock Roquefort story. So Rock's chihuahua drank the poison wine instead and got sick. Remember that? So anyway, Mr. Bottomline now has a new idea for sales. He wants to turn the newsroom into a reality show. American Reporter. Instead of reporting and doing real work, the reporters will need to entertain or be voted off. Journalism is just a game, Brenda muses. And she also says, and when did voting turn from civic duty into cell phone and internet entertainment? So what happens is we have in this American Reporter, we have the people in the newsroom voting each other off. We have a panel of judges, which is the American Idol judges, Simon, Paula, and Randy. And then we also have the American public voting people off. So the first week, the people vote off Pesky. He is a reporter at the Flash, who's been there for a long time. And so he is fired, and he becomes a blogger. And he says, hey, I'm so glad I could quit that job. Now look what I can do. I can be a blogger. Hank, the editor, is the next. And she was fired from the panel of judges, Simon, Paula, and Randy, saying that the paper was boring and it was the editor's fault. Now, Hank was there since, you know, she was a young woman. And so she's really heartbroken. But she says, well, you know, now I get to work on the novel I've always wanted to. So Mr. Bottomline, he says, two thumbs up to dumbing down the readership. Stock is soaring at this one point. And also Brenda says about Hank, well, how can you get rid of Hank? She's our institutional memory. Isn't it true that, you know, there's some places which people have worked there for a long time, that they are the institutional memory for the business, the culture? So another thing that, let's see, another quote in this series up to now is, if you can't believe what you read in the papers, you should at least be amused. So isn't this so true today? So finally, the final episode of American Reporter, where the people get to choose the news and the people who bring it to you. So Brenda is fired. She's the one who's fired by the American public. So she's, you know, decides, well, what am I going to do? So she's packing up her office. It's really sad. And she gets a phone call, and it's a job offer. And apparently a job offer with a very large salary. So we find in the last, we find that the people aren't reading the Flash newspaper because they fired the best reporters. So it sort of backfired on Mr. Bottomline. So the last panel shows Brenda arriving at this mansion. So that's where we're at. Brenda is fired from the Flash, and now she is being courted by somebody else who's going to give her a lot of money to do something which we don't know yet. So that's it. Bah, bah, black sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, yes, sir, three bags full. One for my master, one for my dame, but none for the little boy that cries in the lane. Baba black sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, yes, sir, three bags full. Lazier de Moor. Okay, I just got back from the Lazier de Moor this Saturday afternoon, my second opera. And it was really excellent. Now, I have seen Lazier de Moor in Boston on a much smaller scale, and I liked it. It was good, you know, they did well. But with the Met, the stage is enormous. And, I mean, at any one time, there was, you know, 60 to 70 people on stage. There were 24 soldiers, and I don't think they were singing. And they had an onstage band at one point, and it's just this huge stage. And these steps that go up, and they really made great use of all of the space, having different people, you know, the blocking, having them move around it. Also, the color scheme was like this, like,
I don't know, salmon pink and pastel blues. And the floor, you could tell that they put down a new floor for each production. Because last night looked like stone, right? The whole stage looked like it was on stone, okay? Today, that was for Rhodelinda last night. And today, the stage looked like planks of wood. And, you know, you thought, okay, planks of wood, like oak or whatever. Then you look at it more closely, and each one has, like, a hue to it, like a green or yellow or blue, and then there's, like, splotches of paint. And it was just really good. So anyway, before the opera started, somebody came out, I don't know who it was, and he said that Ruth Ann Swenson, who is to sing Adina, I think that's who it is, she was suffering from allergies, and she was, you know, going to go on and do it, but she just wanted to let everybody know in case, you know, anything awful happened. So people clapped, and, you know, I clapped too, because I thought, well, you know, that's nice of them to say that, you know, instead of just, you know, coming out and, you know, busting out notes or whatever. At the intermission, the guy sitting next to me, Mr. Fatty, I have more to say about him. He's enormous. He sat in the chair, heard it creaking. And he came into the row. I mean, I don't know how it was, you know, hard to, you know, for him to get by. I mean, he was enormous. Not that I'm not Twiggy, but I'm not enormous, you know? So what was I saying? So he said during the intermission, why do people clap that she has laryngitis or whatever? And so I don't know. So anyway, so Ruth Ann Swenson, the whole first act was wonderful. I wouldn't have known she was having any vocal problems. Could hear her clearly. You know, they all did such a great job. Now the tenor, he's new to the Met, I think. His name is... Let me find my program. That's an homage to Miss Wanda Wisdom from the Midwest. Program. Okay, I don't have the program, but okay, here it is. Nemorino is sung by Giuseppe Filianotti. And not only sung by, but played by. I mean, they were all great actors. You know, they did things that I haven't seen in regional opera, which is like Boston. Now, I'd love to know how big the stage is at the Chicago Lyric and how big the stage is at Houston Grand Opera. So I'm going to have to find out. And San Francisco Opera. I'd like to know what the size of those houses are compared to the Met. Met is enormous. It is enormous. I was, again, in the nosebleed section, also known as Family Circle. So it's actually one step below the lowest. Those tickets would have been $15. I paid $36 to $42, so show my status. Though, so, I'll tell you, I had no problem, you know, seeing this production and enjoying it. I did not use the binoculars this time. I didn't take them with me because I didn't want to carry them. But everything was just wonderful. Just wonderful. So anyway, I was thinking about Lazier D'Amour. It was not Lazier Horror, as the Brazilian guy had said. Okay. In Lazier D'Amour, there's a woman named... Get my notes here. Adina. And there's a boy named Nemorino. And he loves her, but he's shy. And she's a flirt, sort of. So it starts off, and she's reading a story, and the whole village listens in. This is a Donizetti opera, by the way. So there's always a village of people, the singing village. And she's reading Tristan and Isolde, the tale of Tristan and Isolde, which was made into an opera by our dear Richard Wagner years later. Because this was written in the, 1820s or 30s. And she just talks about it. Oh, you know what? Lying down here, that doesn't sound good. So, so she reads this book, and he says, oh, if only I had that elixir, she would fall in love with me, because she's sort of cruel to him. And she knows he likes her. She knows he likes her, and she sort of is cruel to him, and he really loves her, and he's just a really shy guy. So, this guy comes in the tent. So what happens then? So then this Belcore comes. He's a sergeant, and he comes into town with his troop. He's a buffoon. It's a comic opera, so they're kind of buffoonish, you know. Think of, like Gilbert and Sullivan. So he comes, and he's like, finds Adina. Is that her name? And woos her. But she says, oh, yeah, I'll marry you. But she's only doing this to make Nemorino jealous. Nemorino doesn't know this. So at the same time, Dulcamara comes in. He's like, he's a guy who sells snake oil. He comes in town in a, you know, like a, one of those caravans. And, yeah, I have the elixir of love, he tells Nemorino, which is only a bottle of Bordeaux with the label ripped off. So he sells him the Bordeaux and says, drink it slowly, you know. It will work in 48 hours and, you know, shake it up before you drink it, sip it slowly. So Nemorino takes it and he drinks the whole thing, gets plastered. And then finds out that Norina, or Adina, they're all the same. That Adina, all these names are the same in the Donizetti comedies. Adina loved, said, to make Nemorino even more jealous, says she's going to marry Belcore. So he talks to Dulcamara and says, but she's going to leave. I need more of the elixir. I don't have any money. So because he has no money, he joins the army for 20 crowns. So he takes the money, buys more elixir. This huge bottle. He comes out with it, and he's really drunk. At this point, we find out that he had an uncle who died, who left him a lot of money, a small fortune. And all one of the village girls found out about this and told all the other available village girls. And they're singing, yes, they sang about how Nemorino now is much more attractive as a, you know, somebody to pick up. So he, you know, this elixir is supposed to make all the girls fall in love with him, right? But all he wants is Adina to fall in love with him. So he comes into the town square after the girls have discovered about his uncle leaving him all this money, and they're fawning over him. He's like, boy, this stuff works. Dulcamara comes in and goes, did I sell him real elixir? Dulcamara comes in and goes, did I sell him real elixir? And of course, Adina is jealous. So she finds out that he actually joined the army to do this from Dulcamara, and so she buys his commission back from Belcore. And then, who is it? Nemorino. All these names. Nemorino finally realizes that, you know, Adina's not, or he doesn't see Adina, loving him or wanting to love him or admitting that she loves him. So he's leaving for the army. And then she comes in and says, you know, I bought your commission. You don't have to go. Stay in the village. And he goes, well, if you don't love me, I can't live here. So finally she breaks down and says, I love you. And then they get together and they're all happy. And it was just really good. It was really exciting the way they ended. And they were waving these flags. And there was a wedding. And it was really nice. It was really sweet. So anyway, I was thinking about L'Isle d'Amour and other operas and similarities. Don Jose. Okay. I'm trying to think of the name of the character in Carmen. But anyway, L'Isle d'Amour is similar to Carmen and Wozzeck. And you might say, how, Kenty? How are they similar? Well, Wozzeck is Nemorino and Adina after they have been married. And he actually ends up joining the army anyway. Because you have, in that opera, there's Wozzeck and Marie, and they have a child. It's not clear whether they're actually married in this opera, but let's assume they are. Actually, they aren't married, but it doesn't make a difference. They're a couple. We don't know if Nemorino really married Adina anyway. And the sergeant is this controlling character. There's also a doctor in Wozzeck, just like, you know, but he's a scientific doctor, not the quack like Dr. Dulcamara, but... So you have the woman, the sergeant, Wozzeck, who is the Nemorino character, the dolt. Nemorino is a sort of adult, and then you have a doctor in there, too. But the sergeant, you know, woos Marie, gives her diamonds and stuff. But it's more realistic, where, you know, she's a slut, sort of. You know, she's doing it for the gold, and it's much more realistic where the Donizetti opera written. Oh, okay, and also Vazza was written in the 20th century, and L'Azur d'Amore is written in the early part of the 19th century. In Carmen, you also have a woman and two soldiers, actually. You know, actually, Don Jose, who's a soldier, and then there's the guy, I forget his name, the other character, he sings the Toreador song, the Toreador. And that he acts sort of like the sergeant in L'Azur d'Amour. There's no doctor.
There's no doctor in Carmen, but...
Vatsik and Carmen is, you know, L'Azur d'Amour become realistic, or more realistic, and tragic. Tragic. He's tragic. So anyway, again today I noticed at the Met, it's really wonderful. They have these starburst chandeliers. There's a starburst chandelier at the very top. And around it are these 12 mini chandeliers. I think they're called the starburst lights or something. That's what they look like. The satellites. They look like satellites. And they hang low. And then before the opera starts, they rise up. And it's like, you know, this ascension. It's really interesting and great. The stage, whole stage area, if you're looking at it, it's like a square. Maybe it's more rectangular than square, but the curtain at the top takes up like a third of that space. And then the rest of it is, you know, still huge. I don't know what the footage is, you know, between the two things. So anyway, things I've overheard, let's see here. Swenson, let me look at my notes here I took during the middle of the act. Oh, I got a sandwich before I started because I was hungry. I didn't have lunch, so I ate lunch there, and I had ham and brie, and I got an orangina. So I paid for it. I'm looking over at this. They have like desserts, little tarts and stuff. And there's a chocolate tart, and there's like an ant or something crawling all over the chocolate tart. I mean, right across the top, right. So I look at the guy and said, thinking that he was going to remove it, and I said, there's like a bug on your tart over there. And he's made this face like, oh! And then he went back to that sort of like, you know, Buckingham Palace guard face. Like, no emotion. But I got him. There was. I mean, there was a bug walking over the chocolate tart. Okay, this production, I thought of the Ziegfeld Follies, because there is dancing and singing, the chorus, and the movement and the spectacle is like that of a Ziegfeld Folly. I just saw the movie Ziegfeld Folly, so that was a nice face. But this is a production. This is a real big production. I mean, last night in Rotolinda, there was a horse in it, which is trouble to me, you know, thinking about horses on stage. But, I mean, they have real flames and stuff. It's real. It's big. It's dramatic. So even if you don't like opera, I would recommend this production of L'Azur d'Amour, you know, at the Met, see at the Met, to any of my listeners. Even if you don't like opera, there's a lot more to see and hear. Plus with the surtitles or subtitles, not subtitles, the they're on the back of your seat, so you can read the English translation. You get a good idea of what's going on. But the acting is so good, you can tell what's going on anyway. Okay, I also overheard today about the Julie Taymor production. Now, last night, Jean and Jan, I don't know if you remember, they were Stephanie Blythe's school teachers back in the town where she's from. And we talked, and they told me I should see The Lion King just because the production is so good. Now, that's Julie Taymor's production. And she also did the magic flute there. So today, the fat guy sitting next to me, whose sight can't go beyond the Twinkie in his mouth, said, I think Gelb, that's the new head of the Met, he's succeeding Volpe, Joseph Volpe, ran the Met for, I don't know, 25 years or whatever, 30 years. So Gelb is succeeding him, and he's saying, Gelb is going to make the opera into a musical. So the guy in the back behind him, he's talking to this guy behind us, because he has the seat for the season, so he knows all the people around. And he goes, well, that's going to be hard to do with Wagner. All I could think of was, you know, some Wagner opera with chorus girls and, you know, like a Broadway show. Like, you know, somebody in there. Brian Stokes Mitchell and Sutton Foster and, you know, who the hell? Oh, yeah, Patti LuPone as Isolde. And then the guy saying, you know, in London, they don't care about opera. They just care that it looks good. Because he was upset when they wouldn't allow Deborah Voigt to play. They said Deborah Voigt wasn't going to play Salome because she's too fat. And he was upset because he's fat. He's enormous. I mean, this is nothing against fat people, but he, I mean, the sides of the arms, right, moved when he sat down. His body heat, he generated all this body heat, and he's, like, touching me because he can't go anywhere. And it was so disgusting. So, and then I think he farted, too, because at the end of the second act, I mean, right, it was like, you know, I had 5 more minutes to go, I'm like, somebody let one loose. Either the 2 old ladies sitting to my right, or he did, and it was like, you know, I couldn't even move. You know, I was like a sardine in this can at the end of the opera. And then finally, you know, we're clapping. I'm like, I have to get out of here. So I'm like, excuse me, let me get out of here. And I ran out and got air. The real great person of this production was, of Les Ayes d'Amour, was the Nemorino. Now, everybody sang great. It wasn't the horror that I thought it was going to be. It's not that I have low standards, but I mean, what's the right thing? I'm forgiving, you know, from a forgiving person, especially like an opera. I mean, it's difficult. I can't believe that they can make themselves heard in that space. But anyway, the Nemorino Giuseppe Filianotti was excellent. And when he came out, they threw down the ticker tape or whatever they do. I think what they do is they rip up the balconies, I don't know what you call them, the boxes, the opera boxes. At the top, what they do is they see them ripping up their performance books and throwing it over. And you see, and it comes down. It shimmers down. It's really, really kind of lovely. But that, you know, it means they like you. And I think he's wonderful. So, you know, keep an eye out for his recordings. Giuseppe Filianotti. He's really good. Really good, I'll say. He's really good. So, anyway, I'm going to save some space. It's 18 minutes for Les Ayes d'Amour. And tonight, I see Miss LuPone and Sweeney Todd. So, I'm going to take a nap now and then get ready and go out to dinner. And that's it. So, see you later.
Hush-a-bye, don't you cry. Go to sleepy little baby. Black and beige, dapples and grays, all the pretty little horses. When you wake, you shall have all the pretty little horses. Black and bays, dapples and grays, all the pretty little horses.
Hello, I just got back. It's Saturday night, and I got back from Sweeney Todd. So let me tell you about my evening. Well, after Les Ayes d'Amour, I came back here and took a nap. It was a restless nap. But I took it, and I left around 5 o'clock. I got up around 5. Now, the opera, the musical started at 8, which means I had to be there by 7:30. So I decided that I was going to walk down 9th Avenue. It's the same walk I took earlier, where they had the food festival, and eat at one of those restaurants down there. Because on Friday night, I ate across from Lincoln Center at the sushi place, and then went to the opera. So, The food festival was going on strong. Tons of people, lots of traffic. It was difficult to walk through. So I found a restaurant called Eatery. And it's at 798 9th Avenue at 53rd Street. So I went in and sat down at the bar. And I ordered myself a Manhattan. And what was it that they used? Maker's Mark. I asked for rye whiskey, but they didn't have any, which is not surprising. And so she made it with Maker's Mark. And I asked for a little extra cherry juice, but she didn't do that. She used grenadine. And it was delicious. It was cold and just wonderful. So I looked at the menu, and it's like comfort food, a lot of comfort food. Like, okay, here is the lunch menu. Sirloin burgers, Black Forest ham panini sandwich, grilled chicken with avocado, asparagus and brie panini, stuff like that. So what they had on there was mac and cheese. So it's this classic dish. So I ordered that. It's called Mac and Jack, actually. I guess it's Jack, whatever that Jack cheese is. So it comes out in this like porcelain bowl, and it's bubbling, and it's the cheese is like browned along the edge, and on top of the of this is these onions that have been battered. Battered and fried onions, and they're thin and crispy, sort of like jerky, like those jerky onion things you put on a green bean casserole. But they're homemade, okay? I mean, they're made right for this. It was so crispy and sweet and delicious, and that mac and cheese was just so delicious. It was like eating a thick cheese soup with noodles. It had a spoon, and that brown cheese was so delicious around the rim of the plate. So I finished that. And so I had a glass of water. And then I ordered their warm chocolate cake with a cup of coffee. Now, this is probably my mistake, because after I ate this, I got so full and I was like almost sick. But it was so good. It was one of these cakes. I figured a warm chocolate cake was going to be like a slice of cake and some ice cream. Well, this thing was like, I don't know, 3.5-inch diameter round cake with like this pudding, like a pudding cake. It was like you broke into the cake and like this pudding oozed out of it, this warm pudding. It was like surrounded with this chocolate cake, brownie-like cake. And, oh my God, it was so good. And then it came with homemade, they make it there, homemade pistachio ice cream. And that was so delicious. So I sat there and I ate that and enjoyed myself thoroughly. And I was talking to the bartender. It's this woman. And then... I finished, I was sitting there, I thought I was going to vomit after I was finished eating. I thought, oh, you know, I didn't plan on doing this, I was going to, you know, get too full too quickly. So, by the time I'm finished dinner, it's only 6:30, no, probably 6 o'clock. So I was like, what the hell am I going to do now? So I walked down to 46th Street. And because along 9th Avenue is a lot of great restaurants, these little, like, you know, individual restaurants, you know, one of a kind. And they're really cool. I mean, the decor and everything. Like, for example, the place at the Eatery, the bar was made of concrete. And the bathroom, I went into the bathroom and the sink was made of concrete. I loved it. I really did. My neighbor actually told me about that. That's new. This poured concrete is really popular for countertops and, bathrooms and stuff. Really cool. So anyway, I walked, continued walking down. I was looking at all the people at this food fair, 9th Avenue food fair. And, you know, all of the different smells were in full swing. The smoke from the barbecue and the deep fat fried, onion blossoms, I guess you call it. They take a whole onion and then dip it into batter and then fry it, and it opens up like a flower, like a lotus. And there's like, you know, sausage and fried sausage. You could smell that with the green pepper and onions. And of course, you know, the screams of kids and the, you know, kids are getting their faces painted, and they have different games like these beanbag tosses. And it was really fun. It was like a big street party, and it went on for blocks and blocks and blocks. I mean, at least, let's see here, 63rd, well, let's say 60 to 47, what's that? You know, 60 to 47, well, you know, 10 blocks, 13 blocks, at least 13 blocks. No, 14 blocks. I was at 46th Street. So I turned on the 46th Street. Anyway, I'm getting on the 46th Street is this reason. At the restaurant, I told the bartender, I said, you know, this is like Restaurant Row. She goes, actually, Restaurant Row is 46th Street. I'm like, well, whatever, Sharita. This is good enough for me. I'd like it better than, you know, well, 46th Street, though I've never eaten at any of the restaurants on 46th Street. But anyway, I turned on the 46th Street, and it is Restaurant Row. And there's like these fancy, fancy restaurants. You know, all these fancy French restaurants and all sorts of things. Hello. And so that was that. So I went in there. So I still had an hour, 6:30. I was like, what the hell am I going to do for an hour in Times Square? So I just was walking around. I wanted to sit down, actually, because I was so full. And I'm still belching, though I had a nice long walk home. I'll talk about that. So let's see, where was I? So I was on 46th Street, went into Times Square. And then I decided to go to the Colony music store, where I got some other sheet music. They're really great for sheet music. Their CDs are expensive. Like, they're selling mid-price Columbia musicals, like anything anyone can whistle, which you can get for $11.98 at Tower Records for like $25. I'm like, why do they even, like, who buys it there, you know? Apparently they have a reputation, like, if you can't find it anywhere but Colony, you know, Colony will have it. And they do have a lot. And so I went in there and I bought vocal score selections from Evita, and I bought Richard Rodgers vocal selections from Rex. Richard Rodgers' penultimate musical. The last musical he wrote was I Remember Mama, and that was 80-something. He died. But, let's see here. Oh, I was reading in the thing, in the preface to Rex. I mean, Richard Rodgers had a stroke, had a heart attack, had jaw cancer, and then he had cancer of the larynx, that sort of came in the middle of this Rex, you know, writing Rex. He suffered a lot, you know? Ooh, I have some water here. I'm going to have some water. He suffered a lot, you know? Ooh, I have some water here. I'm going to have some water. So I was in there for about a half hour. And they're really weird in Colony, the Colony music store. They're very, I don't know if they think you're going to steal from them or whatever. They're very, like, unfriendly. It's the unfriendliest place you could shop. So I was finished there, and then it was like, I don't know, it wasn't 7:30 yet, because that's when you can go into and sit down at the theater, Sweeney Todd. So it was like 7:20, and I went over there, and people were, you know, just milling around. So I asked the guy, and he said, yeah, just stand right here. There's the line where it's forming. So I was first in line. And then as soon as I was only standing there for a few minutes. I was looking at my scores, and a ton of people, you know, came up behind me. And then there was like, you know, it was really a lot of handicapped people were going to go see Sweeney Todd. And people were bringing their, like, five-year-old children to see Sweeney Todd, which is kind of a violent musical. The musical is about a barber who was incarcerated under trumped-up charges, and he's been away for 15 years, and he comes back to find out his wife, he thinks his wife is dead, and his daughter has been taken by the judge who had put him into Botany Bay in Australia. So he comes back with revenge to kill people. And that's what he does throughout the musical, is he slices their throat. So he's after Judge Turpin. And it all ends up bad. You know, he dies. But, so that's Sweeney Todd. It was at the Eugene O'Neill Theater, which I think is the same theater where I saw Passion, another Sondheim musical. I saw that in 94 when I came to Boston. 94, I think it's 94, 96. And that was really great. Oh, and here's a little history of the Eugene O'Neill Theater. It was built, theater opened as the Forest Theater in 1925, and it's very nice inside. It's really cool. It's small, though, compared to the Opera House, the Met Opera. I think I described it for you already, but this was a lot smaller, a lot more intimate. I was sort of, as I got closer to seeing Sweeney Todd, I mean, I had the tickets already. I paid, I don't know, $111. I was in the orchestra seat, and I was thinking to myself, oh, do I really want to see this, you know? I mean, I really love Sweeney Todd. Now, this is my history with Sweeney Todd, is that when I was, you know, 15 or whatever, whenever it came out, I really wanted to see Sweeney Todd badly. This is like my Annie thing. You know, this is after Annie. I was a little older, and we saw the commercials for Sweeney Todd. I'm like, I love Sweeney Todd. And I really liked horror books when I was at that age. So I thought, wow, this is a musical. Because I remember reading the review in the Philadelphia Inquirer Bulletin, maybe at the time. And about how it's like a horror musical, and I thought, wow, like, I love Annie, and I love horror movies, and I love, how much better can this be? So I never even had a chance. I didn't even get down to Philadelphia to see that. We just never had the money, so I saved my money, and I begged my mother to get me the original cast album, and we went around all over the place to find this damn thing. Finally, I found a copy of it, and it was $20. I didn't realize it was going to be that much. My mother hemmed and hawed, but she finally bought it for me. And that original LP release was cool because it was in a, I don't know what you call that, a fold-out, like, you know, those classic rock albums. You fold it out, and you see all the pictures, you know, but this pictures were of the production, and there's a huge libretto right there in the middle, and it was like the really exciting, you know. So I remember putting on it for the first time, and I thought, God, this is like, you know, I thought it was like opera, because it wasn't like anything I've ever thought of as being a musical. It was dark, it had all these, like, you know, like all this instrumentation and complex chords that I wasn't even, you know, didn't think of, you know, I wasn't aware of. It was an eye-opener musically for me. So I remember listening to that. I used to listen to it every day after school. So I know the music really well. And then I had gotten when I got into high school in the library, I was looking at, you know, I used to get a library at the study period, and I found that the school had the libretto, the book, and I took that out, and one other person took out that book, Todd Gross. Now, Todd Gross, he was a year ahead of me, and he was the high school Broadway star. He was in all of the Broadway shows. He always had the leads. I mean, even when he was in 10th grade, you know, he'd get leads in these plays. And for his senior year, they put on Man of La Mancha for him because he really wanted to do Man of La Mancha. And so he was, and I remember seeing that. It was really very good. You know, who knows what I think today, but it was so magical, it was so exciting. But Todd Gross loved Sweeney Todd, and I did too. And that's it. I didn't really look up the him. I thought he was interesting, but he was, you know, he wasn't in my, he's nobody I would have ever hung out with. He was in a different, I don't know, different level or different, he was in, he walked in a different circle than I did. So that's Sweeney Todd. So I heard about this, you know, and I thought I was really excited and I wanted to see it. And I bought the tickets, and after I bought the tickets, I bought the soundtrack, the recording, the original Broadway recording. And when I heard it, I thought, I only listened to it once, but I thought, oh, geez, you know, is this really, you know, gimmicky or whatever? Let me tell you, though, I have to listen to the recording again, give you my final word on that, but it's worth, you know, coming to New York and seeing the Sweeney Todd. It is a truly ensemble cast experience. I mean, there's 10 actors. They play, you know, these 10 roles, and they each play an instrument. There's no orchestra. They play the instruments. Everything is orchestrated perfectly, and there are these sort of symbolic gestures that to stand in for certain things, like when they cut the throat, they don't, you know, in the original production, apparently blood spurted out, and there was a lot of gimmicks like that. But in this, they do a slashing motion, and then they have somebody, the right lights go red, and then they have somebody else, another character, usually Mrs. Lovett, pouring this bucket of blood into another bucket, so you see this blood dripping. And it's just really good, you know. And when I first, you know, actually was the first few, the first, I don't know, 10 minutes of this, I thought, oh, I wonder if this is going to be any good. How can anybody be better than Angela Lansbury in the original cast? And, you know, Patti LuPone did a really great job as Mrs. Lovett at recreating this character in a wholly different sense, more erotic and bad, and just, it's just a different, you know, whole different, okay, I'm looking at the television, there's a nun playing the recorder, and there's a black man, I don't even know the name of the, let me turn it off, hold on. They call me Mr. Tibbs. Okay, let's hear the recorder. So, okay, I'll have that as background. Okay, she's playing the recorder, but I don't hear her. Oh, there it is. It's, what's his face? They call me Mr. Tibbs. To Sir with Love. What's his name? Sidney Poitier. And nuns. Italian nuns. Yeah, you'll see how you were nuns. So anyway, back to Sweeney Todd. It was terrific. And anybody who comes to New York, you know, that's worth seeing. So anyway, listen, and ends up, you know, this YMCA business is really great. It's clean, it's mostly, you know, it's actually nice. All the people who are nice, it's not like hobos, you know. So I know everybody was surprised. I was staying at the at this establishment, but you know what? For $88 a night, actually, I upgrade $92 a night. It's worth it, you know, because I'd rather spend my money on musicals and stuff like that than. At the hotel. However, if I had the extra money, I'd stay at a real hotel, but, you know, what are you gonna do? What are you gonna do? Anyway, tomorrow I leave. Amen. 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 Oh, so, okay, yeah, I was walking home. So after the musical, I decided to walk home instead of taking the subway. I've used the subway once, and I'll use it again when I go down to the Penn Station. Because I'm not going to walk to 24th Street or wherever. Where the hell that is, but... I'm going to turn this down. Okay, she's teaching the nuns how to sing spirituals. I wonder what this is called. Nuns. Okay, so I'm going to turn this off, go to bed. But anyway, I walked home and there's people in front of me, they were smoking pot. That's it.
You've been listening to The Flake Show. You can reach me at 206-339-JOSE, or you can reach me at Kenty@theflatishow.com.